Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 19, 2016, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call as today we discuss recent developments at the CFPB. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guests, two of them, to our program today. We'll hear opening remarks from each of them. They're actually going to go back and forth between the two of them, covering various issues and recent developments at the CFPB. We're going to start with the Honorable Wayne A. Abernathy. He's Executive Vice President for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association, and then we'll hear from Julius L. Lozier, Jerry Lozier. He's of counsel at Winston & Strawn. With that, Wayne Abernathy, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, Dean. Thank you, everybody, for listening in. It's a pleasure to be able to discuss with you some of the most recent developments involving the Consumer Bureau. I'm Wayne Abernathy, the American Bankers Association. Jerry Lozier here, as Dean said, from Winston & Strawn. He's joining us from Chicago. Both of us are members of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group. Jerry leads our working group on the Consumer Bureau and every month puts together an outstanding list, summary, of some of the more significant activities of the Consumer Bureau for the previous month. And we're working from that list in our effort today to share with you some of the key items in the 20 on that list that Jerry's put together for the month of September and up through including October 11th. So we'll focus on some of the most notable items on that list, after which we'll be very happy to take any questions that you have to discuss these issues further, or go into any of the other items that we did not mention, but which might be of particular interest to you. To begin with, we think probably the most significant development involving the Bureau in the last several weeks is the court decision of the Court of Appeals for D.C., the Circuit Court of Appeals for D.C., on the PHH Corp. et al. V. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. My first point that I want to make in connection with this case is that this case will be the subject of a full Federalist Society teleforum this coming Monday, October 24th at 2 p.m. So we will leave for that teleforum the detailed discussion of this very interesting and important case, but we can't escape touching upon it and hitting some of the key elements for you today, and certainly if you have any questions, we can go in those to some degree, but again, keep in mind that we'll have that teleforum exclusively devoted to that case next Monday afternoon. There are two elements of the decision of the court. One is a constitutional issue. The other is a series of opinions, judgments, with respect to some administrative law issues. On the constitutional issue, the court found that the structure of the Bureau is unconstitutional. And the court made that decision based upon the view that the Dodd-Frank Act, as it created the Bureau, places too much executive, legislative, and judicial authority all in one person, the director, who under the statute can be replaced by the president only for cause. The court decision remedied that constitutional flaw by striking that phrase, the for cause limitation, on the grounds for that the president can use for removing the Bureau's director. In their view, that would make the Bureau a regular executive branch agency directly answerable to the president, and that would resolve the concerns that the court found with regard to constitutionality of that structure. The second element of the case focuses on three aspects of administrative law. The court ruled that first, the Bureau could not retroactively apply a changed view or interpretation of a statute, which is what the Bureau did in the particular case. The court also ruled that the defendant, PHH, correctly interpreted the then existing rules, and this is under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, RESPA, that the PHH company correctly interpreted what was the then existing RESPA rules regarding reinsurance arrangements. And the third decision of the court on the administrative law elements was that statutes of limitation apply to administrative proceedings as well as to other aspects of the statute. The Bureau had proceeded on the grounds or the opinion that the statute of limitations governing RESPA did not apply to administrative proceedings such as those that the Bureau was engaged in, the court disagreed. Again, while we'd be happy to discuss any questions you may have during our Q&A segment, I'll refrain from saying more about this case for now, and again remind you of next Monday's teleform at 2 p.m. on this case. But before we go to our next item that we want to bring to your attention, let me turn to Jerry Lozier and see if, Jerry, you have any comments or questions you want to make on this particular case or anything else introductory.
Sure, Wayne. Thank you. I just want to take 1 minute maybe to go through the reasoning as to why the court found it was unconstitutional to have an agency head who was only removable for cause. What the court did was it looked to the U.S. Constitution. Obviously, Article 2 provides that the executive power is vested in the president. He, of course, may appoint subordinate officers. And in a 1926 Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court held that the president may remove those subordinate officers at will. The court then suggested that separation of powers cases are resolved by focusing on history and longstanding tradition, and it had actually asked the parties to provide lists of any executive agencies with substantial authority that had ever been held by a single person who was not removable at will by the president, and it concluded there was no such agency ever. It did note there are, of course, multi-member agencies who cannot be removed at will by the president, independent agencies, but the court reasoned that the members of those agencies serve as a restraint on one another, and thus they are accountable, whereas there was no such restraint in the case of a single director agency. So that's all I would add, Wayne.
Well, I think that's very good color. Appreciate that, Jerry. I think now I'd like to proceed to our second item, which is really closely related. This is the issue of a deputy director and some very interesting opinions and discussion about the appointment of a deputy director at the Bureau or the fact that there hasn't been an appointment of a deputy director at the Bureau, only an acting. Jerry, you want to take that?
Sure. This is based on a blog post on September 9th, more than a month before the PHH decision came down. So the substance of it may be affected by the PHH decision. But the blog post was by the president of the Consumer Bankers Association, and it was titled, Five Things the CFPB Should Do to Be More Widely Respected. And the very first thing dealt with the fact that there has been a longstanding absence of a deputy director, a permanent deputy director at the CFPB. There's been a vacancy in that position since last July. And the blog post cited a rumor circulating apparently inside the Beltway that the director of the CFPB may be playing politics with that position on the logic that if a Republican is elected president and the Democrats end up controlling the Senate, then the president could nominate a new director of the CFPB, but the Democratic Senate could block that nomination, leaving it to the existing director to appoint a deputy director. And then when the existing director's term expires, he will have, in essence, appointed his own successor. Now that, as I say, that came down before the PHH decision. I'm not sure the logic of it works even irrespective of the PHH decision, but of course under PHH, the president can remove the director at will. But of course that case may well be appealed, and it may not be final for some time. So that's that development, Wayne.
Well, the whole question of a deputy director I found to be very interesting given the way that the Bureau is structured. Under the law, under Dodd-Frank Act, the deputy director, should the director leave office for whatever reason, then inherits all of the authorities that the director had, all of them. As you know, that's often the case, but those are very extensive authorities to be passed on to somebody not only who had never been confirmed by the Senate, but this is somebody who never even been appointed by the president. And given the possibility that it could be very, very difficult to get anybody confirmed by the Senate to replace Cordray when he does leave, you could have that deputy director who has no ties to anyone other than that he was appointed by the previous director, wielding enormous authority for a very long time. Again, assuming that it would be very difficult to get anybody confirmed to the Senate, regardless of who it is, which I think is just a real problem. Now, it could be that the PHH case gets interpreted in such a way that if the director can be removed by the president, then presumably that also would apply to the deputy director, I presume, and anyone else. It would be like a typical executive branch agency where everybody in that agency can be removed by the president. So maybe the PHH case solves that particular problem. It'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we can then move on to our next topic, and that is payday lending. And I'll lead off here and then hand it to you, Jerry, for any comments you may have on it. The comment period on the Bureau's proposed rule to regulate small-dollar lending, including payday loans, has closed just about a week or so ago. Reports are that as many as 1.5 million, no exaggeration, 1.5 million comment letters were filed in this proposal. A record for the Bureau and unusual for any agency. It's not a record for any agencies. I think the record's about 4.5 million on some cases, but that's certainly a record for the Consumer Bureau and extremely unusual. 1.5 million comment letters on a proposed rule. The Bureau views its proposed rule as addressing what the Bureau sees as very high-priced loans that, in their view, can entrap borrowers in recurrent and mounting debt spirals. That's the theory behind the Bureau's rulemaking here and their proposal. The Bureau is open about its intention under the rule to shut down much of the payday lending and auto title loan markets, reducing availability by the Bureau's own estimates by some 60% or more. The proposal would also extend to accommodation loans made by banks and others, and these are the kinds of loans that are small dollar, short-term, made for amounts of a few hundred dollars for auto repairs, appliance replacements, other sorts of consumer uses, sometimes emergency situations. Estimates are that some 50 million people each year rely upon short-term, small-dollar loans, the kind that would be affected by this rule. The Bureau does not say where those payday loan customers will go if the rule makes those loans unavailable. Jerry, any comments you have on this topic?
Well, the one thing I wanted to bring listeners' attention to is an op-ed piece that was published in the American Banker newspaper about 2 weeks ago. It was an op-ed piece written by two Washington, D.C. lawyers, one of whom is a former CFPB official. And it has to do with the payday lending proposed rule. The title of the op-ed piece was, quote, "How the CFPB's Unfairness Doctrine Pushes the Envelope," unquote. And what it explains is that under the proposed payday lending rule, it is, quote, unfair, unquote, for a lender to make a covered loan unless the lender has made a reasonable determination that the borrower will be able to repay the loan. And then the rule goes on and sets forth a method by which the lender is to make that kind of a determination on the borrower's ability to repay. Essentially, the proposed rule would set forth an underwriting standard that lenders would be expected to follow, and failure to follow that method would be deemed unfair, which is, of course, illegal and is sanctionable by the CFPB. So any other loan underwriting standard would be deemed unfair, even if it's more predictive of the ability to repay than the standard set forth in the reg, or if it's a cheaper but equally effective method, it would be unfair and illegal for a lender to use that standard. And that's what the thrust of the op-ed piece is. Wayne,
Jerry, doesn't that point to what has been a worry that people have had since the creation of the Bureau, that the Bureau might engage in the practice of actually designing its own products and saying, this is the only right and proper way to offer this particular service to customers around the country.
Wayne, I it's hard to argue with you on that. That sure seems to be what will be going on.
Yeah, it sure feels that way, and I like this concept of the unfairness doctrine as opposed to the fairness doctrine.
Yeah.
The unfairness doctrine being created.
The unfairness doctrine.
Yeah. Well, in a related issue, and this now regulation of consumer debt, Jerry, you want to talk about a Bureau blog post about student debt and minorities? And I do find this interesting, how the Bureau seems to want to do a lot of policy initiation through its blog. But if you want to talk about that.
Okay, absolutely. The background on this is that student loans constitute a huge focus for the CFPB and historically have done so. Student lending is the second largest type of consumer debt outstanding in the country after home mortgage debt. There's something like 41 million Americans owing student loans in a principal of amount of about $1.3 trillion. There's also a widely reported very high default rate. Something like 8 million borrowers are supposedly in default on their student loans. And this has huge consequences for the macro economy. Borrowers who have this kind of student loan debt cannot afford to save money to get a down payment to buy a home. It affects demand for housing. So it's pretty serious. But over the years, as the CFPB has talked about this problem and the problems related to student loans and student loan servicing, it has never had any kind of political component until now. On September 15th, about a month ago, the CFPB issued a blog. As Wayne says, it fires off these blogs from time to time. And the title of the blog was, quote, "The Significant Impact of Student Debt on Communities of Color." And the blog noted that 66% of white fourth-year undergraduate students have student loans, but 72% of Latinos who are fourth-year undergrads have student loans, and 90% of African-American fourth-year undergraduates have student loans. And the blog goes on to suggest that this disparity in the amount of student loan debt may actually drive the income inequality problems in the United States. So suddenly this phenomenon that the CFPB has been so concerned about over the years suddenly is colored with an interest group component that had not been present before. So I thought that would be worth mentioning.
Well, I think it is, Jerry, and it's what's interesting to this to me is how the Bureau plays with numbers and tries to cast them in what seems to be a preconceived approach. I looked at those numbers and I thought, okay, I see how they're using them that way, saying, okay, 90% of African Americans and 70% of Latinos have this student loan debt, as if student loan debt is a bad thing. But just think of it, if you put the numbers around the other way, wouldn't they make just the opposite case? Let's say that the numbers showed that 90% of whites had student loans and only 66% of African Americans and 72% and so forth of Latinos. Wouldn't the attitude then be, well, look at that, why are whites getting loans and the minority groups are not? So it seems to me that they cast the numbers to fit what is already a preconceived notion.
Interesting way. Very interesting.
Well, it's a concern. If you look at the way the Bureau uses the numbers, what we would like to do, and this is, I think, something to be very valuable, is if the Bureau would share, when they make assertions like this based upon data, if they would share the database from which they make their calculations and make their assertions so that everybody could look at it and we could have a public debate based upon the same data and same information.
Mm-hmm.
There's an area for reform potentially. Well, if we can, let's turn to a management issue. Well, actually, no. Let's do the other side of debt is saving. The other side of borrowing is saving. And the Bureau has been active on the saving topic as well. And they've come out with a tools for saving. Jerry, you want to talk about that?
Absolutely, Wayne. And this is sort of a bit of humorous, I think, a humorous story. It was about 2 weeks ago, the CFPB issued a report called Tools for Saving, Using Prepaid Accounts to Set Aside Funds, unquote. And the report is about a research project that the CFPB undertook on incenting prepaid card users to save regularly. And on this research project, the CFPB researchers actually contacted 540,000 users of prepaid cards. So to me, that is a huge study and a very expensive study. And they offered each of these 540,000 card users one of four different types of incentives to save in order to test which of these four incentives would be the most effective. The first incentive was an email highlighting the benefits of saving. The second alternative incentive was a refrigerator magnet on those same benefits. The third was encouraging the use of an automatic transfer feature. And the fourth alternative incentive was $10 to a person saving $150 by X date. And surprise, surprise, the most effective incentive, it turns out, was the financial cash incentive of $10 to save $150. So we don't know what the cost of this research was, reaching 540,000 card users, but they found out that financial incentives actually are more effective than emails and refrigerator magnets and encouragement. So I thought that was a little humorous.
$10 more of an incentive than a refrigerator magnet. Who would thought?
Exactly.
Who reminds me a little bit of, for those of us who, like myself, are a little bit older on the call, never thought I'd be saying that, but folks that are like myself, a little bit older on the call, it reminds me a little bit of the win buttons of the Ford administration, the Whip Inflation Now campaign that they had, an effort to basically just psychologically get people to end inflation by wearing red buttons that have WIN on it, Whip Inflation Now. Yeah. The program was less effective than was hoped.
I don't know.
It's fascinating. Anyway, next item, if we can, we'll turn to, is Federal Reserve's Inspector General. These are management developments. The Bureau is an agency of the Federal Reserve. That's the way it's structured under the Dodd-Frank Act. That, among other things, means that the Inspector General of the Bureau is the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve. And that Inspector General has jurisdiction to review Bureau operations. The Inspector General of the Federal Reserve is, of course, the Inspector General for the Bureau. And they looked into Bureau operations. And on September 29, the Fed issued a memorandum regarding Bureau management. And it wasn't entirely favorable to the Bureau, as I recall. Jerry, what were some of the highlights?
Well, two of the highlights had to do with information security and policies and procedures. And the information security management challenge identified by the Inspector General was that information security was not being effectively ensured by the CFPB, that current information security monitoring, that program is actually manual. There is little or no oversight of the security protections that contractors that the CFPB uses have in place, and that the CFPB has not fully implemented processes to detect and to protect against unauthorized access to the reams of information that the CFPB collects on credit card holders, mortgage borrowers, et cetera, et cetera. And the other criticism, comprehensive policies and procedures were not in place, and those that were in place were not being followed. And the IG reported an example that when it came to approving travel card expenses, there had not been any training of managers as to how they should approve, what they should approve. So those were two of the management challenges that the IG saw at the CFPB.
Well, I'm particularly troubled, Jerry, by the finding that the Bureau has yet to implement an effective process for detecting and protecting against unauthorized access to information. And that's because the point that you raise is of the enormous volume of data that the Bureau has insisted that credit card companies, they're now seeking information from credit reporting agencies and others. They have a deal with the FHFA to take in mortgage information and to warehouse all that inside the Bureau, which makes the Bureau a very attractive place for people who are looking for consumer information to go. And yet here the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve says their ability to protect and defend that information is seriously lacking. That should be a serious concern for a lot of us whose data may be the next breach of the Social Security system on that scale of violation of information. I think it's very troubling.
Very troubling.
Well, those are some of the key items we promised to just give you a few. We think those are very significant ones. We got 20 on our list, but we think those are some of the most significant that we wanted to share with you at this point. I think it's probably appropriate for us now to go to any questions that callers may have, Dean.
Terrific. Well, in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a full half hour remaining. We've got two questions pending. Let's take our first call of the day.
Okay, caller, go ahead.
Oh, hello. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a private citizen, and I was just listening to this discussion about the CFPB. I am frightened to death of this organization. It's a monster. Is there anything that the new administration could do to have this thing reviewed, or have Dodd-Frank reviewed and repealed? Because this thing is frightening, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you make a very important point that as a regular consumer, a regular citizen, you're the type of person for whom the Bureau was ostensibly created to protect. And yet it seems to me that with every new rule and action that the Bureau puts forward, they're actually controlling you and me rather than the providers of financial services. They're controlling the consumers.
Absolutely. And that's a problem with a lot of these agencies. They're controlling where the Constitution doesn't allow them to control.
Yeah, yeah. Jerry, any thoughts on what a new administration could do to rein this in to some degree?
Well, Wayne, as you know, there is pending and has been pending in various Congresses since the CFPB was adopted legislation that would change the structure of the CFPB to change it from a single director to a commission of five members. And there have been some very cogent arguments proposed that would bring expertise. Right now, the director is an expert in enforcement and litigation. That's his background. He's the former attorney general from Ohio. But they could use experts in privacy, experts in technology. They could use geographic diversity. It would help. So that's one piece of legislation. Also, we haven't mentioned it, but you may be aware that it is not subject to the normal congressional appropriations process. By the Dodd-Frank Act, its budget, the Federal Reserve is to turn over 1% of its, I can't remember, I believe it's the expenses of the Federal Reserve or the net or gross revenues of the Federal Reserve, which is enormous, to the CFPB, and that works out to about $500 million a year. to fund the CFPB budget. So that is not under the control of Congress. So, you know, the CFPB would, you know, it gets very defensive on this issue, and they do report semi-annually to Congress what they're doing. Both how they appear, the director appears in front of the committees, and its rules can be overturned by there's a body of something like 8 or 9 other agencies called the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which by 2/3 vote can overturn a CFPB regulation. There are some controls, but so there are things that can be done, and there's legislation pending. But the president, I believe President Obama has threatened to veto, I'm pretty sure, the commission structure or the appropriations process.
Now, I think the PHH case could loosen things up a little bit to where Congress might be more willing, Republicans and Democrats, to consider some reforms of the Bureau. We'll have to see if the case is upheld on appeal. We assume it will be appealed. But if it is upheld the way it is, it sets up some interesting anomalies. If the Bureau, as the court has determined, is an executive branch agency, as far as I know, it would be the only executive branch agency that is not subject to appropriations, that draws its money from an independent agency, the Federal Reserve, and if it is seen as being an executive branch agency, being nestled in the Federal Reserve, I think works to compromise the independence of the Federal Reserve. And so I could see where there is certainly, doesn't force congressional action, but it would kind of give a feel that something needs to be done legislatively to fix some of these particular problems. So a lot of it could depend on how that court case gets resolved.
Wayne, may I clarify one quick thing for everyone? And that is, you know, you have, of course, correctly mentioned a couple of times that the CFPB is technically, legally part of the Federal Reserve System. However, the Dodd-Frank Act explicitly provides the Federal Reserve shall have no authority or ability to influence the decisions of the director of the CFPB.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. In fact, I've often made the point that when the Bureau comes and says, here's our budget, give us the money, all the Fed can do is say, do you want that in 10s or 20s?
Oh, brother.
We're speaking with Wayne Abernathy and Jerry Lozier. This is Dean Reuter. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. And let me, if I could just augment or follow up, and if you either of you want to respond to this, I have understood from the PHH case, which probably will be appealed, that along with this new removal power, of course, a new president could remove the director, but sort of subsumed within that is a president's ability, a determined president, that is, to require the CFPB to send all its rules through OMB, to send its proposed budget through OMB or OIRA, and those sort of lesser included responsibilities. So that's one thing I think that could change with a different president. And also, there are other legal challenges that may be confront in a more direct way the constitutionality of the structure of the CFPB. So I don't know that we've heard the last word from the courts on this as well. So now we have two questions.
Yeah, you raised a very important point, Dean, about having to run their budget through OIRA. I hadn't thought about that, but OMB governs the budget of all the executive branch agencies. Mm. Very interesting point.
May I make one more comment?
Please, and then we have two other questions pending, but let's hear again from the same caller. Go ahead, sir.
Really quick. I'm just looking at it as a private citizen, but I think the Federal Reserve System ought to be amended or done away with. I think that's another agency that's outlived its usefulness.
I think that'd be a very interesting topic for another. Yeah, I was going to say, Dean, I think it's a good topic for another call.
All right, maybe we'll look to that. For now, if you'd like to talk or ask a question about the CFPB, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Two questions pending, so let's take another call.
Go ahead, Blake.
Oh, I'd just like to point out that the student loan debt is partly a function of the fact that no student can absolve himself of that debt by declaring bankruptcy. And I'd like to point out during this campaign that that the person who signed that law was Bill Clinton. The lenders became seem irresponsible because there's no way that the students can get out of the debt, so the lenders don't really consider how much debt is being taken on. And that's encouraged the schools to raise their prices to absorb whatever money the students can commit to. So that law is probably the thing that's most responsible for bringing in that student debt. And of course, in terms of curing the problem of the Financial Protection Board, abolishing the Federal Reserve would solve the problem of their over-intrusiveness.
Yeah, very, Jerry, any comments you want to make on that?
Well, I can't resist echoing the comment about the schools have raised their prices. That I may be a minority. At least there's two of us who feel that way. I got to confess, I've never taken an economics course, but I did work for 8 years at the Federal Reserve, fresh out of law school, and I like to think that that's almost like taking an economics course. And it's fundamental economics, I think, that if you have an increase in the amount of money available for a fixed service or good, the price of that good is going to go up. And so when you have the federal government shoveling money into the student loan system like it has done, that is what is driving college tuition up. I'm just absolutely convinced of that. And that's just my amateur economist side of me talking. But I'm really convinced that that's why, when people decry, $60,000 tuitions at these colleges, it's a function of the federal government incenting student lending and itself being a major lender. Wayne, can I just add one other thing?
Yeah,
and I'm really going out of the soapbox here. Imagine what is going to happen to our economy as this student loan debt, $1.3 trillion, whatever it is, 8 million, that's 20%, I think, of the borrowers in default. Eventually, what is going to happen to our economy when that debt is realized? And I'm sure the federal government is going to want to bail out the students and heaven help us. That could be the next financial crisis, I've heard people say. But anyway, off the side.
And as I understand, I think something like 90% or so of student loan origination is now in the hands of the federal government. They've taken over most of those student loan programs. And their view is, let's provide the funding and then let the consequences go where they go. And now we're seeing. Thank you for that, question. Go ahead.
I think that bailout is more likely to be for the banks than for the students. It'll be disguised as a bailout for the students,
good
but
point.
It's the banks who are going to be reimbursed.
Very good.
Well, in a sense, they already are, because if you say about 90% of it is government guaranteed one way or another, that means the taxpayer is behind it. The banks really don't have much skin in the game, and since the federal government's taken over most of the student lending. So I think you're right. If you want to know who's going to be paying that in the end, go look in the mirror.
Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending. Let's take another call.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to ask one question as a practicing lawyer who have several clients involved with payday lending with astronomical interest rates. And is it your position there are no abuses in pay lending? And two, isn't it possible that traditional banking institution could provide some of the same payday lending type of loans at a much lower and more reasonable interest rate?
Well, I think you raised some very good points, and I don't think any of us on the call would want to defend bad lending practices. I certainly wouldn't want to do that. And then I think you make and I don't want to say by saying that, I don't want to make the point that all payday loans are bad, but when people, whoever it might be, has gotten himself or herself into a situation where head over heels in debt and can't get out, that's a real problem, and you want to look and see what the cause of that was. Now, your point about banks playing a particular role, I certainly have heard from a number of banks. They would very much like to get into that business. The challenge is when you're making a loan of $400 or $500, the bank, and this is for a short period of time, maybe for 2 or 3 months or whatever, the bank is not going to earn, interest-wise, maybe much more than $50 off of that loan. And it is very difficult to do the underwriting that's necessary in order to process that loan, figure out if the loan is payable and so forth. But what a number of banks have tried to do is make various loan products available for their regular customers. And they say they can do that with small dollar loans because these are people who are already bank customers, so they already kind of know them. They've got a history to look at, and that can reduce the cost of underwriting the loan. The problem is that the Bureau's proposal, their proposed rule, would make it impossible for banks to do that as well. The costs that the Bureau would impose are so high. They would require anybody who's a lender in this space, bank or otherwise, to do an ability to repay test evaluation that's pretty close to what you do for a mortgage. So you're going to follow the same kinds of underwriting that you do for a $500,000 mortgage, applying that to a $500 loan, and a lot of banks would say, I can't afford to do that. I'd lose money on every single loan I made, and that would drive a lot of them out of the business. So I think the answer is partly what you're saying, bring more reputable sources of lending into the process. The proposed rule doesn't seem to offer that opportunity. I don't know. Okay. Jerry, you have any views?
None that you haven't expressed, Wayne. You took the words out of my mouth that, you know, the conventional criticism here is that the amounts of the loans are so small and the term is for such a short period of time that lenders cannot afford to make them at, you know, at a 10 or 15% interest rate. They need to charge much higher charges in order to cover the cost. So that's, you know, that's the knock on the CFPB proposal.
Yeah. Thanks for Matt offering that question. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We still have two questions pending, so now let's take yet another call.
Great. Go ahead, caller. Go ahead with the question.
The caller, you might have your telephone on mute. If your phone's on mute, we cannot hear you.
It's Warren Belmar calling in.
Go ahead, Warren. We can hear you now.
I just wanted to share some background information on the student loan problem that you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, please do.
First off, it's the only loan that I know of where there is no obligation on the part of the borrower to show any ability to repay.
Yeah.
So that is why it is such a popular loan. With respect to the statistics, Jerry mentioned that there were 8 million or so people in default out of the 40-some-odd or 40-plus million people that have student loans currently. That is more encouraging than it should be, because more than half of the 40 plus million borrowers are still either in school or on some kind of a deferred category. So the 8 million are really part of the 20 million or so student loan borrowers who are in the category of, or who are potentially default. So it's, let's say, 8 of 20 rather than 8 out of 40 million, 8 million out of 40 million. The other thing that's rather bothersome is to take a look at the ages. There are now 1 million people in default out of the 8 who are over the age of 50.
Wow.
And there are different age groups. There's information. I'll send Jerry and a copy of an article I wrote 2 years ago summarizing some of the problems that exist. And I think the commentators did identify one thing that's rather troubling, which is we had to borrow the $1.3 trillion in order to lend it out, or the $1.1 trillion, which is the federal government portion, either guaranteed or actual. And while there might be incentives to forgive the borrowers, the people we borrowed from have no intention whatsoever of foregoing our obligation to repay them. So we are looking at a straight bottom line deficit increase, if you could continue to borrow, to cover any forgiveness that does occur.
Well,
and that scary part, given the fact that we're approaching $20 trillion in debt already. Anyway, that's all I had to add. Thank you.
Well, that's excellent information, Warren. And I'd always thought, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, that student loans were a particularly risky loan because not only is there no ability to repay, there's no collateral. You're basically making a loan against a future income stream that may or may not develop depending on what kind of an education the person gets and what kind of a job he or she can turn that into.
Absolutely correct. What is scary, though, is that the number is in excess of 30% of those in the loan repayment category who are in default.
Yeah, very high. Well, thank you for all of that information. Jerry, any comment you want on that?
The only comment I would make for the audience would be to let them know that Warren Belmar is an active member of our financial institution practice group and is very active in the Administrative Conference of the United States and obviously is extremely well-informed.
Yes, thanks for making that point, and that's all very true.
Yes, thank you, Warren Belmar. This is Dean Reuter. I have a question about the student loans since we're on that topic. Aren't they also unique in the sense that they are government-subsidized, government-backed, government-insured? And it feels to me like there's some tension there to the extent that the government, on the one hand, is supporting these loans and promoting them and making them easy to get, and on the other hand, now the CFPB is coming in and criticizing the prevalence of these loans.
Yeah, well, I've noticed that too. You read in the press a lot of criticisms from the administration about student loans. They never talk about student loan origination. Never mention that. It's all about the servicing. Say, well, you're not servicing the loan properly, rather than you're making loans to people who can't pay them back. You're making loans that are too much for this, that, or the other. I think it's an excellent point, Dean.
Well, when the CFPB is citing these failure rates, the percentages that you cited, or default rates, doesn't that sort of go to the origination?
Yeah, I think it does. I think someone has put us on hold. There we are.
I think that's right.
I think when a loan defaults, one or two things have happened. Either it was there was an origination problem, or if the origination, the underwriting was done properly, then something else has happened to the borrower that's inhibited that borrower's ability or willingness to repay in the future. And a lot of the focus from the Bureau has been focusing on the latter part, where there has been, for some reason, some inability to pay, but they don't focus on the origination problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to suggest, too, that the default problem, this is Dean again, might get worse. I understand from others in the Federalist Society membership ranks that the EEOC now is asserting that when big business recruits on college campuses, so if IBM or Google or whomever goes to a college campus to recruit new employees, that is under disparate impact analysis age discrimination. So it might be harder and harder for graduating college students to get jobs if employers are faced with that. But in any event, we still have two questions left. So let's take another question from a new caller now.
Great. Go ahead, caller.
I'm just kind of wondering what the difference is between a payday loan and having an ordinary credit card. Because if your definition of payday loan was broad enough, it might encompass everybody's credit cards.
Well, it could. The proposed rule does not reach directly to credit cards. It excludes them. But you're right. There are various ways that you meet this problem of small dollar short-term loans. I use a credit card when I buy something at the grocery store for $5. And I'm getting a $5 loan from my credit card company off of that. The credit card company is able to do that because they maintain an ongoing relationship with me. They did their underwriting up front. And if I only made one, took out one loan based upon that taking out the credit card, I probably was going to cost the bank something. But because I maintain that relationship over years, that's how the bank reimburses itself for doing the underwriting. The difference between a credit card and the payday loan is that a payday loan is one time. One loan just focuses on that specific loan, not an ongoing relationship, whereas with a credit card, you have an ongoing relationship. But both of them are solutions to try to get at the definite need that is there, that we all have, for smoothing out our income and our expenses. Our expenses are every day. Our income is not every day usually. It's maybe once or twice a month, or depending on what your particular employment may be, it's still going to be sporadic and not match your income short-term loans of some kind or another smooth that out for us.
Don't payday loans generally result in an ongoing relationship between a frequent user of a payday loan and the lender, and doesn't that give the lender some track record for them to make judgments on?
Well, the payday lender, and what you mentioned is definitely true with a large percentage, less than half, but still a significant percentage of the payday lender, when the loan is due, doesn't have enough money to pay it off in full, and so we'll take out another loan to pay off the previous loan. A number of folks do that, and that's one of the concerns that the Bureau and others have with those sorts of loans. But the payday lender doesn't take that into account usually in its underwriting. Whereas a bank or somebody who's got a regular ongoing relationship with a customer would. And so that's a significant difference. Unfortunately, the Bureau rule gets at that in really a ham-handed, partial way, again, that affects not just the payday loan, but anybody making short-term loans. They basically say that under their rule, you would not be able to make more than two loans in a row without a breathing space in between. Maybe that addresses the question of borrowing one payday loan to pay off a previous payday loan, but it then hampers the ability of a bank that has an ongoing relationship to establish an ongoing lending program with its customer.
It also renders the borrower unable to deal with short-term income losses if they have to pay off the previous loan before they can get the next one.
Yeah,
I think the U.S. government behaves that way, doesn't it?
Well, and I think there are a lot of correlations. Jerry, any comments on this?
Not really, no.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question. I appreciate that.
We have time for a final question, and we have a final question. So let's turn to what I think is our final question of the day.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask about the student loan. The way I hear you all talking about it, it seems as if you have little to no sympathy for the borrowers who are in over their heads, and I'm wondering, from a conservative point of view, don't we have or shouldn't we have strong opinions on the impacts that having the government be the monopoly holder of this kind of loan creates problems for these kids? The education costs have skyrocketed so far that you can no longer work full-time to pay for school. So the only way you can go to school is your parents have to make $250,000 a year in order to comfortably pay for your education for you, or you have to take out that loan. And loans are all held by the government, so there is absolutely no incentive to treat you fairly with customers. You know, there's so many lawsuits against various entities of the student government, Sallie Mae and so forth, that every time they get sued for violating the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act or any number of other issues, they just rebrand themselves and change their name and do the same thing over again. Because without the competition, there is virtually no other option for these lenders. And we tell people, you know, hey, school isn't for everybody. You shouldn't have to go to college. But that's not realistic. We have to have lawyers and doctors and engineers. And we've now got a generation of Americans who can't buy homes, who can't finance cars, you can't finance families, our population rates are dropping, all because of this student loan debt. And I think it's nice to say what a terrible, you know, drain on the economy it would be if we forgave this debt. But what about the drain on the economy long term of having a generation of people who can't take care of themselves because they can't discharge this debt ever? So
yeah, very
for the rest
point.
Of their lives, right? Because the interest is going to go up forever. If you can miss the payment or forbear it or whatever, but even if you do that, until the economy's better, these students are now looking at $20,000 in debt becomes $70,000 in debt, law school debt becomes $400,000. At some point, we have to ask ourselves, what do you think? Which economic impact is more important, the impact of forgiving the debt, a one-time thing, or the impact of having a whole generation of people not buying homes, not buying cars, not moving out of their parents' houses, and not having children?
Yeah, Jerry, any comments on that?
You know, I do, and I'm going to sound like an advocate for the CFPB, but, you know, what was just described is a big concern to the CFPB, and they one of their main criticisms of student loan servicers is that student loan servicers do not promote the programs that are out there that the Department of Education, which I think originates something like 90% of the student loans, has for deferring the payment of student debt and to lower the payments, extend them out over, you know, 20 years, to forgive them after a certain period of time. But there are programs that are out there, and the CFPB is trying to promote those programs, I know. And it criticizes student loan servicers for not promoting the availability of those, like, loan mitigation, you know, loss mitigation programs. So, and, you know, I've not gone on the CFPB or DOE websites, but I believe if you go on there for looking for student loan relief, that there should be stuff there that would help, that should help students. And so I don't know if that's responsive, but Wayne, what do you think?
I think the caller makes a very good point. I think what we have is a situation where I think part of the point that you're making, Jerry, about how funding of education by a number of different sources actually has resulted in raising the cost of education. So I, at the core, getting at the student loan problem, a big part of it's going to be getting at the cost of education. I'm hopeful to some degree as a father of a son who's currently in college and having put four others through college, I'm hoping that technology is going to help significantly to bring educational costs down, and that may help some. But those who already have the student loan debt, there's some very serious issues there that need to be looked at.
Well, it looks like that is our final question of the day. We've got a couple minutes left. Let me give each of you a chance to express a final thought, and you can go in whatever order you'd like.
Well, why don't you lead off, Jerry?
Oh, gosh, I guess this has been a tough month, I think, for the CFPB. The PHH decision, I think, is very, very significant. There have been articles written subsequently to the decision to the effect that this is going to make the CFPB a lot more careful in some of the things that it does. People who didn't listen carefully to what Wayne described as the facts in the PHH case, they really were outrageous. Applying a PHH had followed to the letter a longstanding interpretation of the law, only to have the CFPB take over that area of the law, change the interpretation, and then retroactively fine PHH more. Initially, the administrative law judge said it was $6 million. The head of the CFPB says make that $109 million, and there's no statute of limitations. You know, it's just... It really seems, I think, to any fair reader that it was an enormous overreach. So hopefully this will maybe cause the CFPB to be a little more reticent before just going off the deep end and being abusive here.
I agree, Jerry. I think the PHH case is an example. I think the 1.5 million comments on the payday lending proposal, the 50,000 comments filed on the arbitration rule, the inspector general report. I think what we're seeing is what happens when you have any agency, any entity that wields governmental power that doesn't have adequate accountability. Adequate checks and balances. Over time, they're going to become more and more excessive, act less and less responsibly, and I think we see that starting to build up at the Bureau, and hopefully at the same time it's going to build up the pressure for reform and bringing this into a better harmony of accountability and checks and balances. That's what I hope is for going forward.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean. Thank you once again. This is a recurring series, a regular routine to give us an update on the CFPB. I appreciate the work of both of you in this regard. We've mentioned it a couple times. We do have a teleforum next Monday looking in detail at the PHH case. They'll talk about that case and nothing else, so that will give them an opportunity to go a little deeper on the case. Before then, this Friday, our next scheduled teleforum conference call, Samsung versus Apple, that huge patent design case that finally made its way to the Supreme Court. We'll have a special courthouse steps edition of that examining what transpired at oral argument. But until the next teleforum, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.